shut down the shipping traffic from ashen mud floats. The United States had never seen such destruction in its history. Eruptions have continued from 1980 to 1986 and 2004 through 2008 as the mountain attempts to rebuild itself, as nature always does. With an event like this, people had no idea how long it would take before this area would return to normal. Some scientists estimated hundreds of years.
Because rapid evacuation might be necessary, tourists and sightseers are urged to stay out of the area. But the warnings have the opposite effect, and tourists pour in from around the country. Souvenir vendors hawk t-shirts and bottles of genuine volcanic ash.
Was completely blown off.
With 40 missing, far more needed evacuation. Rescuers quickly became heroes.
Dad, you want to go to a mob?
These were the folks that survived the blast, but they weren't out of danger. The mud was coming.
Would you get off the bridge?
The snow and glaciers on top of the mountain melted, combined with the ash to form dreaded lahars, mud flows that would extend this disaster miles and miles away from the mountain itself. The world turned black and white, even on color film.
Some volcano enthusiasts try to get as close to the summit as possible. One of them is Robert Rogers, a 29-year-old radio technician with a passion for mountain climbing. He makes a game out of outwitting the sheriff's department.
I would drive up and go,
oh, is it really dangerous up there?
Oh, yes, son, it's very dangerous.
Well, do people try to sneak in?
Yes, we saw a guy up there 2 mornings ago in a blue sleeping bag.
Oh, really? Tell me, what did you do then?
And they'd explain what they did to try to catch me. Because I was the guy in the blue sleeping bag.
For geologists, however, watching the mountain is no sport.
You just didn't have time to do anything but eat and sleep and work.
Clear weather brings out a record-breaking number of tourists and television crews. News choppers airlift reporters to the summit, ignoring the danger warnings. They are rewarded with 18 small bursts of steam and ash throughout the day.
The fishing industry will be hurt by the loss of millions of fish killed when volcanic ash and steaming mudslides heated the water to over 90 degrees. Silt and debris from the volcano virtually closed the port of Portland this week. The Columbia River Channel, normally 40 feet deep, was half filled and unpassable in some sections. The Army Corps of Engineers has begun dredging operations, but it will be at least July before the port is ready for normal traffic. Royal Kennedy, ABC News, Portland.
Good evening. A new plume of ash rising 45,000 feet and pulsing at 10-minute intervals like a steam engine. That is the description of today's major eruption of the volcano Mount St. Helens. It was the biggest blast in a week of a series of volcanic activity which experts now say could continue for several years. The latest from Royal Kennedy.
Because of blowing ash from this morning's eruption, motorists were warned to stay off the roads. Some of those who didn't heed the warning were involved in this 14-car pileup on Interstate 5. 20 people were injured, two of them seriously. Earlier in the day, driving conditions were just as bad when the ash combined with rain in a smoky mud. Motorists were forced to stop periodically and hose down their cars. Many drivers turned on their car radios to get information about the current emergency and the long-term health effects of the ash.
Tom Jacobson of the Environmental Protection Agency says the EPA is worried about very small particles of ash.
Those particulates, if a person is subjected to heavy or prolonged exposure, can produce illness such as emphysema, acute bronchitis, or other respiratory diseases.
In Longview, Washington, the ash storm not only blocked out the daylight, but left the city totally without power. The ash is also threatening the city's water supply, and residents are being asked to use as little water as possible. Geologists say this morning's eruption is just a continuation of yesterday's activity on Mount St. Helens. They say it did not rearrange the surface of the land and was not as dangerous as last week's blast. but they point out that ash from volcanic eruptions is something the people of this area will have to live with for years to come.
Standing on the landing gear of the helicopter, ABC News cameraman Tony Gonzalez photographed the headwaters of the Toutle River this morning, and he reports that the layer of ash is much heavier since last weekend's eruption. Our chopper was climbing toward the peak of Mount St. Helens, and here, looking toward the rising sun, we see the rim of the crater. Directly over the crater, the plume of steam and ash. Only a light dusting of ash fell on our helicopter inside the crater. Two earthquakes rattled the mountain this morning following yesterday's tremors, which indicated the movement of molten rock within the mountain. Search teams were out in force today after being called off because of the tremors. Unknown is the significance of this morning's quakes, 4 and 3/8 on the Richter scale, which were centered under Mount Margaret, 10 miles north. Mount St. Helens is relatively quiet for the moment. Stephen Geer, ABC News, Portland, Oregon.
ABC News correspondent Steve Fox and 2020 cameraman Bob Brandon and soundman Phil Lauter are the first network news people to have set foot on the mountain itself since the eruption. Steve and the crew spent 2 days last week with a search and rescue team.
The danger area is from the mountain to just north of Spirit Lake.
Because they don't even know for sure they're in there. If they can get me a vehicle here, I'll put a ground body in.
They plan. They talk. They calculate every risk as they work grueling hours to battle the disaster. Using every means of communication, local officials and active army troops share information, their most valuable weapon in the assault on Mount St. Helens. Deputy Sheriff Mike Copenheffer leads the combined forces on search and rescue missions for possible survivors of the eruption.
If we get a confirmed missing on a vehicle, we're going to get a ground crew in with support with the helicopters. Will we fly them in or drive them in, depending on the weather?
Sheriff Sergeant Randy Hamilton instructs local volunteers in emergency search and rescue. He says the results have been especially rewarding on Mount St. Helens' rugged terrain.
A successful mission is when you find what you're after. And I think the personal pride involved is being able to work with the volunteers, seeing volunteers come out that you know that work at the bank during the day or work at a mill or run a farm, that when you call them, they come.
They come here to a nearby village firehouse, anxious to help friends, relatives, and neighbors. The volunteers and regular Army helicopter crews drop other responsibilities to concentrate on the rescue effort. Each morning, women from the community prepare donated food for everyone, including Hauser, the German Shepherd tracker who will travel with the rescue team. There are 50 Army troops here and 20 civilian volunteers. The mood is one of cooperation, not competition.
The camaraderie is wonderful. And I think the Army men know that our men know the roads, know the area like the back of their hand. They're taking the risk because they hope maybe they might find someone still alive, hold up somewhere there. And of course, all the bodies have to be brought out too.
Swarms of quakes followed. Until March 27th.
We are directly over Mount St. Helens right now, and there is no question at all that the volcanic activity has begun. You can see smoke and ash pouring from the top of the mountain, especially on the north side of the mountain.
A concern for public safety prompted the closure of the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest. What scientists had anticipated, the eruption of Mount St. Helens before the end of this century, had begun.
Other option, he begins walking toward his only glimpse of hope, a tiny sliver of light in the ash-blackened sky. He rolls his video camera, capturing what he thinks are his last moments on Earth.
I never really thought I'd believe this or say this, but at this moment, I honest to God believe I'm dead. There's really no way to describe those feelings. I feel the ash now in my eyes. It's getting very hard to breathe. Burns to breathe. And the little talking burns to breathe. Burns my eyes. Oh, dear God. My God, this is hell.
Like the Kearneys, Crockett made it out alive. But many people were not as lucky.
Weeks after after the initial eruption, scientists discover an alarming bulge on the north side of the mountain. Magma, rising within Mount St. Helens, has encountered a blockage in the mouth of the volcano and is being forced out around it. Scientists, like volcano hazard specialist Dan Miller, explain the danger to emergency agencies, but little is done.
As the weeks passed and nothing serious happened at Mount St. Helens, it became more and more difficult for us to convince the various agencies, both state, federal, and local, that something ugly was about to happen.
Over the next 2 weeks, the bulge on the north side of Mount St. Helens grows larger every day.
The mountain was moving at such a rapid rate, about 5 feet a day or so horizontally, just day after day after day after day.
Officials finally heed the scientists' warnings and establish a so-called red zone, a safety perimeter that extends from 3 to 8 miles around the summit. They begin evacuating residents. On the banks of Spirit Lake, less than 5 miles from the summit, an 84-year-old resident named Harry R. Truman, no relation to Harry S. Truman, tells reporters he has no plans to leave.
That's my life. Spirit Lake and Mount St. Helens is my life, folks. I've lived there 50 years. It's a part of me. That mountain and that lake is a part of Truman, and I'm a part of it.
Truman's defiant
camps leading to flooding, sweeping away homes.
I had made up my mind I was going to make it. But the wife and my friend wanted to give up, and I couldn't.
And it wasn't over.
A mushroom cloud of ash and black smoke soared 10 miles above the Cascades. In the cities east of the mountain, the sun was snuffed out as ash fell like snow.
But even as many found rescue, the disaster was far from over.
Dawn on Monday broke like the first day on a strange new planet. Up the Toodle River Valley, the destruction was complete.
40 years ago, they wore masks too, but for a different reason. For much of the state, ash was everywhere.
That ain't bad, I mean. That ain't good either.
The ash had to be shoveled, like snow. It wasn't going to melt.
Part of the house is still standing, and we left with the shirts on our back. I'd like to get back in.
It was as scary gets, because you didn't know what was coming out of the sky. You couldn't see. It was hard to breathe. The kids were crying, saying, Daddy, are we going to be all right?
The mud, now stopped, set like wet concrete. President Jimmy Carter came to see for himself.
Somebody said it looked like a moonscape, but the moon looks like a golf course compared to compared to what's up there.
And still the mountain boiled. It would erupt twice again in the next month, showering ash over Portland and Olympia, Washington. But this eruption, this blast, the equal of a 50-megaton bomb, was the most dramatic in at least 500 years.
There are five.
Within the crater itself of a lahar, a mud flow emanating from the crater if there's a significant eruption.
It's happened before. During the 1980 eruption, the mountaintop glaciers dissolved, joining rock and other volcanic debris to form a massive lahar that swept down the Toodle River Valley. This is not a scene residents want to see repeated. At the USGS National Volcanic Laboratory in Vancouver, Washington, seismographs act as an early warning system, gathering real-time earthquake and tremor information from sensors placed on the mountain.
We're always monitoring Mount St. Helens because it is the volcano that's erupted the most frequently in the Cascades.
Hydrologist Steve Schilling says there is reason to take notice of what's happening in the crater.
Now, because it erupted in 1980, it did not remove all hazard. So I can show you as comparison here between 1980 and 2000. And so you can see as I flicker that on and off, the dome grows and the increase within the crater, sort of a horseshoe shape around the dome of the snow and ice and rock that's accumulating. And so that's a fairly quick period of time for this glacier to develop. Eventually what this will do is fill up, and in who knows how many years from now, eventually we'll have another mountain like it looked prior to the 1980 eruption.
...than we first thought. Through massive tree planting efforts, as well as encouraging natural growth in the blast zone, life has come back, and the recovery has been amazing. As early as the late 1800s, local residents would come up for a leisurely drive through the massive old-growth forests, first by horse, then by automobile. They would horseback ride and camp in the hundreds of square miles of this amazing outdoor wilderness. Eventually, summer cabins, lodges, and youth camps dotted the landscape, drawing visitors on a regular basis. During winter, adventurers would hike the mountain, then ski down its almost perfect slope. The more daring would ice hike, then camp at the top for an amazing view. The diehards started clubs for climbing and skiing, all for the enjoyment of spending time at the mountain. Anglers of all ages took advantage of large trout, and there was no better place to cool off than in the glacier-fed waters of Spirit Lake. It was a recreational wonderland.
I remember one particular winter when we hiked into the Y Camp and stayed there for 2 or 3 days. It was a beautiful, beautiful area up here.
My wife and I and kids spent days up here in this area. You could drive all day in the Weyerhaeuser Road system and the forestry roads and never see the same thing twice.
Mount St. Helens' beauty was a bit deceiving, for it was a young volcano, lying dormant beneath its pristine glacial peaks.
Most of what the mountain we know today was built in the last 2,500 years. So it's very, very young, very active geologically. It has basically grown up since the last glaciation. So Mount St. Helens was very smooth and symmetrical cone-shaped volcano, and very much like Mount Fuji in Japan.
This area was prized for its recreation, for its great beauty, and also because it held some of the most valuable commercial timber on the planet. In fact, Weyerhaeuser's biggest parcel was just north of the blast zone. Nobody had a better appreciation for its value than Dick Ford, who is the superintendent of the land for Weyerhaeuser.
Another one of our reporters, Joe Rico, was on the ground along the Toodle River today. Right now, Joe is in Toodle Lake, and he files this report. No, he doesn't file this report. We are not going to have his report right now. But we can tell you that the ash was so thick today that in many places visibility was practically zero. That meant roads had to be closed. Interstate 5 was closed for 8 miles. That's where it crosses the Toodle River, blocking hundreds of cars, trucks, and buses. I believe now it's open only to emergency vehicles. I-90, the major east-west route in Washington State, was closed for more than 40 miles. US 12, which runs east-west around 20 miles north of the mountain, was also closed for about 90 miles. And on the question of Harry Truman, we have been getting a lot of calls about his fate. As you know, he's the 84-year-old man who refused to be evacuated from his home on Spirit Lake. Skamania County Sheriff Bill Closner, contrary to the report Boyd Levitt has, Skamania County Sheriff Bill Closner says he talked with Truman yesterday at his home in Spirit Lake.
Lake, and he fears that Truman and his 16 cats have probably been swept away by mudslides. There have been continuous flows of extremely hot ash, steam, and pumice flowing straight down, apparently into the Spirit Lake area. About 30 feet of debris, we have a report, has covered the area. If Truman stayed, there is very little chance that he survived. As Ralph said, he did say he planned to hole up in a secret mine shaft with two kegs of whiskey and wait for the worst to pass. We can only hope so. He was the only permanent resident living near the mountain who refused to be evacuated. We now have reports of heavy ash fallout from as far away as Butte, Montana. In northeastern Washington, there was so much ash that it was like night in the middle of the day. We have pictures of Yakima, Washington, for instance, which seem almost unbelievable. There weren't many cars on the street, but those on the street, as you can see, had to use headlights. Ash was falling like rain for several hours, and planes at the Yakima airport were covered with a thick layer of this stuff. Our photographer, Tom Sr., also took some photos, these photos, about noon today in the Trout Lake area of Washington. The plume of ash was clearly visible, but it was getting darker there by the minute.
Sense of authority makes him a folk hero overnight. May 1st, 1980. A month has passed since the first eruption. Without another major event, public excitement dies down. But the ominous bulge on the mountain continues to grow. The U.S. Geological Survey sets up a new observation post, Coldwater 2, 5 miles northeast of the summit. This one is 3 miles closer to the volcano than the existing site at Coldwater 1. At Coldwater 1, Roe Finley, an assistant editor with National Geographic magazine, is interviewing 27-year-old photographer Reed Blackburn when the ground begins to tremble.
I looked to Reed without saying anything, but with concern, and he said, "Earthquake, I think it's about a 4.5.
The earthquake is just one of many that occur each day on the volcano, but any one of them could trigger an eruption. Blackburn, on assignment with the Vancouver Columbian newspaper, is ready if the mountain erupts. He is positioned where he can trigger two remote control cameras placed 1 mile from the summit. A graduate student manning Coldwater 2 must leave for the weekend. Geologist Don Swanson and his colleague David Johnston agree to take turns filling in for him.
Dave said, "Okay, I'll do it for Saturday night if you can come up on Sunday and replace me."
May 17th, 1980, 8 a.m. It's been more than a month and a half since the first eruption. Despite the fears of USGS scientists, many of the residents evacuated from the red zone are convinced that the crisis has passed.
Smoke soared 10 miles above the Cascades.
The ash is extremely slick on a roadway, makes it very hazardous condition. Visibility is down to zero.
In the cities east of the mountain, the sun was snuffed out. A terrifying darkness at noon as ash fell like snow. At least 25 people were dead.
Well, I'm not going to take it down.
40 others were missing.
Nobody's going to take it down. It'll take me down and I'll walk motor down that road.
Blast
backwards when I come down that road, or I'm not leaving. And I'm not going to take my name off.
I've made up my mind.
I've sandblasted. I've changed it five times in my life, and it's going to sit there and rot down.
Wanted to give up.
I'd like to see the man that's going to take that sign off that post.
Just
I don't know.
It is Thursday,
March
20th, 1980.
Realize
the last people to witness the volcano's power had seen her erupt in 1857. Since then, the mountain has been quiet. Now, an earthquake rumbles deep inside St. Helens. She is awakening after a 123-year slumber. Steam. There are thousands of small earthquakes. There is no major eruption. There are no fireworks. But the watchers come from across the country and around the world, hoping they will be the ones to see the fury if it comes.
I just want to see a volcano at work. I don't think it's going to blow at this point. I think it's just going to sit and simmer.
Overworked and undermanned, the police try to keep sightseers out of the area. They try, too, to keep residents away from an uncertain danger.
I have about $7,000 for snowmobiles at my cabin and at my home site. Under my own responsibility, I go up and get them.
Hey, we wouldn't be in there 10 minutes.
I know, but that's
all the longer it takes us to go in there is about 10 minutes and get the hell out of here.
At this point, the volcano is still a novelty, a curious smoking reminder of our primitive past. There is no hint of a deadly future.
He's saying, huh? The
volcano is still a novelty.
Own responsibility, and I go up and get
him. No, sheriff's order.
Hey, we wouldn't be in there 10 minutes.
I know, but that's
all the longer it takes us to go in there is about 10 minutes and get the hell out of here.
At this point, the volcano is still a novelty. Pack up and leave.
The mountain had a newly opened crater, measuring about 250 feet in diameter. The earthquakes continued. Forest Service and cooperating scientists went right to work.
845.
Ringing the mountain with an array of gadgets, hoping to document even the slightest twinge. The Forest Service ordered immediate evacuation of its own nearby ranger stations, such as this one on Pine Creek on the southeastern flank of the mountain. They also strongly urged others having homes, lodges, or camps near the mountain to do the same. On the morning of March 29th, a second crater was observed, which had opened during the night. The new crater measured 75 feet wide and 30 to 60 feet deep. On March 31st, explosive eruptions continue, and the two craters merge. For the next several days, the mountain continued to spew ash and steam. Then, eruptive activity decreased. However, a bulge noticed earlier on the north-northeast flank of the mountain near Goat Rocks was found to be moving north-northwest at about 5 feet a day. Scientist David Johnston expressed the opinions of the U.S. Geological Survey. They would later prove incredibly accurate.
In the initial phases, we'd see probably very large eruptions that would extend high into the air. This would spread ash over large areas in western Washington, maybe possibly in an extreme case, even farther east. In the near flanks of the volcano, there would be more damage done by possibly hot avalanches, pyroclastic flows. Farther downstream, we could see mud flows and floods.
Because this is such a symmetrical volcano, and because the crater is so high, if there's an explosion, it's probable that the debris, the very hot incandescent ash that would come down all sides. But right now, there's a very great hazard due to the fact that the glacier is breaking up on this side of the volcano, on the north side, and that could produce a very large avalanche hazard.
In the meantime, the chief of the Forest Service declared part of the land around the mountain a geological area to help protect the unique features. The Forest Service and the U.S. Geological Survey were taking the mountain seriously, as did the Spirit Lake youth camp operators.
They gather at the roadblock nearest Spirit Lake. Tempers flare as they try to return to their homes.
We're paying taxes and we'd like to use our property. I'm not afraid.
Governor Dixie Lee Ray relents and gives them permission to visit their homes today and again on Sunday.
Everyone had to sign waivers, releasing the county from any blame for what might happen to them while they were inside the red zone checking out their property.
The beautiful day brings a number of campers out into the Washington woods. At Jericho Hole on the Tootle River, 25 miles west of Mount St. Helens, high school sweethearts Venus Durgan and Roald Reeton parked their car by a favorite fishing spot.
There were no other people around us at all, so we just listened to the radio and sat up.
Roald has hidden a bottle of champagne deep in their cooler, a surprise treat for Sunday night. 6 miles west of the summit, Ty Kearney, a ham radio operator, volunteering to monitor the mountain for the state of Washington, receives a transmission from a fellow volunteer, Jerry Martin of Concrete, Washington. Martin has stationed his radio van at a perfect viewpoint, just 7 miles away from the bulging north side of the mountain. Backpacking with his wife, Lou, and their two young daughters, three-month-old Tara and four-year-old Bonnie, Mike Moore passes up two campsites.
This was Bonnie's first backpacking trip. We wanted it to be something memorable for her.
In all, 57 people died on May 18th and the days thereafter. Thousands of acres of forest are flattened, roads covered in hundreds of feet in ash and mud, logging equipment, homes, everything destroyed. The mud flow continues down the Tootle River all the way to the mouth of the Columbia, stranding ocean-going freighters in silt. Was a very long day.
Earlier today, we had an accumulation of up to about a half an inch, I would say, right here. Now it's even more than that. In some places here, it's dripped into an inch high, this volcanic ash. It's very fine. It looks, in a way, glass-like, kind of like sand you'd get on a beach. It's very fine, and again, as we said, it gets in your hair, it gets in your clothes, everywhere, and we're going to get it for quite a while longer.
The first thing, the memory that it brings back is how much thinner I was 20 years ago. But what memories it brings back is I would say, the drama of this event and what it really meant to the people of Yakima.
Allen is now a journalism professor at Arizona State University, far removed from the Yakima Valley and the disaster he worked so hard to inform viewers about 20 years ago.
This was a few hours after the eruption, and even though it is probably around 3 o'clock or so in the afternoon, as you can see, it is pitch black outside.
Allen and Boyer spent much of the day driving around Yakima, from the hospitals to City Hall, trying to gather as much information as possible.
We're going to have another wave of volcanic ash here over the next couple of hours. Denise, what do you have for us? You have some closures here. You've been talking to people the last few hours. What do you have going for us?
That's right, Craig. I've been sitting by the phone for at least the last hour, and we've just had a flood of phone calls come in.
We had a ton of information. I mean, we had just stacks of notices and things that needed to be conveyed. And as you can see, you probably noticed right there, I was shaking the card because the ash was continuing to come down as we were doing the live shot.
While the north and the west sides of the volcano felt the brunt of the eruption's force, the ash cloud was blown due east. And while areas like the Tri-Cities were relatively spared, Yakima was covered in a dense layer of gray, sand-like material. And when the sun finally broke through, days later, residents there began to ask themselves, how do we get out of this mess?
Some 3 miles away. Behind me is Bear Meadow. That's the place where those incredible pictures were taken. 10 years ago, a group of Seattle campers decided to come up to this area to record history. And indeed they did. William Dilley was a member of that party, and he told me that he was lucky he made it down alive.
And I decided to sit down on the log, drink some coffee. Gary set up his camera, and through the binoculars, I seen half the mountain cave in. And start coming toward us real fast. And at that point, I decided we better move and get out of this area because, I mean, as you could see, half of it was gone. And, I mean, it wasn't going to stop. Disoriented me and to where I did look away once, maybe just because I really didn't want to see what was really happening. And I figured as long as everybody was kind of idle, standing around, not really standing around, I mean, we're scared to death. I might as well try to let other campers in the area know what was happening, because there was no sound. It was more of a visual experience. And when I saw that much land moving at one time, I knew we were in for some trouble.
The eruption that rocked the Northwest, Mount St. Helens, 10 years after, will take you back a decade to a moment in Northwest history. From those astounding pictures, you and I tend to concentrate on the explosion part of the eruption.
Volcanoes in Washington State, Mount St. Helens is just one of them. The question, when is the next eruption? In Mount St. Helens, Glenn Farley, King 5 News.
Going on. When the first earthquakes occurred around March 16th, it shook the mountain, and as you might imagine, the snowpack on there, we started seeing avalanches in places you didn't ordinarily see avalanches. And so this is some pictures right after those first shakes took place. We saw more of this. So part of our job was to forecast both the weather and also the avalanche danger.
And
the scientists working inside of the red zone.
Here's a good example. Studying the glacier helps scientists calculate how much ice, snow, and rock is accumulating. And whether something short of an eruption, like a big earthquake, could cause a lahar is one of the things geologists want to find out. But the glacier is now big enough that a lahar, if it happens, will probably cause considerable damage.
This used to be almost flat, or let's say a 10-degree angle slope, if you take all that mass out, going all the way around the dome. That's how much has accumulated since 1986. The lahar hazard would be tremendous because all the glaciers that were obliterated in 1980, half of that mess is back in the crater right now. It would take 5 million dump trucks just to get all that snow mass out.
The Toutle River Valley still bears wounds from a series of lahars in the 1980s. The danger today is aggravated because the mountain's throat has been blasted wide open, and only an aging sediment dam, miles downriver, stands in the way of the next debris flow.
I've been in the area my whole life, but after becoming a forester for Weyerhaeuser in 1970, I became eventually a district forester. Mount St. Helens actually grows some of the best trees in the world. There's no other place in the world that has this amount of rainfall and these productive of soils to grow Douglas fir. And it is the number one building wood in the world. This was our largest district that we had anywhere in the world, and Weyerhaeuser at the time had nearly 35 million acres. So that tells you how large this was.
The last known eruption of the volcano was in 1857, and in the decades that followed, hardly anybody thought it would erupt again. Suddenly, in early 1980, the mountain began to show signs of life.
We were just doing our normal stuff, and one day we got a notice that the Mount St. Helens was becoming active, and we were to leave the area for a while, at least until they could understand. And the first notice was some very deep, long earthquakes that indicated, because they were right under the mountain, that it was something occurring inside of the mountain. As days followed and the mountain cleared up, we started seeing some cracks forming, very large cracks forming in the mountain. And then day after day, there began a buildup. Well, we didn't know what was happening,
but
there was a magma pool
who ran for their lives. About an hour ago, Tom called to say that the ranger station near Trout Lake is almost in complete darkness now. And volcanic ash reached Spokane, Washington by 2:30 this afternoon, and that city apparently is in complete darkness. The ash is falling down like snow, they say, making driving very hazardous. Highways are closed, the airport is closed, and hospitals are receiving people with respiratory problems who were caught outside. Ralph?
Robin, right now the ash has not seriously affected Oregon. The winds are carrying the ash east. However, in case it does become a problem on this side of the river, it does pose a threat to crops and animals. And so Senate President Jason Bowe says he will immediately convene a special session of the Legislative Emergency Board to provide any emergency funds that might be needed. Also at this point, the ash poses no problem to the Portland water supply at Bull Run.
Portland State University has offered us some statistics on ash fall from past eruptions around the world, and they give us some interesting examples of what we might expect. Krakatoa in the Pacific erupted for 90 days in the 1880s. The mountain went off with a bang that was heard about 3,000 miles away, but all the ash that fell from Krakatoa came down in the first 2 days. Hekla in Iceland erupted nearly 200 days in 1947. Almost 90% of the ash fell in the first day. Lamington in New Guinea erupted for 45 days, but most of the ash came down on the first day. Same thing again with the 1955 eruption of a volcano in the Kamchatka region of the Soviet Union. A 150-day eruption, and most of the ash fell in the first day. Ralph?
Several years back, geologists have predicted an eruption of St. Helens, and they made some predictions on where the tephra was likely to fall. John Tuttle has that report.
With eruptions of St. Helens considered a near certainty, the big question was where the tephra would fall. Geologists were predicting that eruptions with small amounts of tephra could come every 100 years. Moderate eruptions about once every 500 to 1,000 years, and significantly larger eruptions only about once every 2 or 3,000 years. Where that tephra would fall, of course, depended on the way the winds were blowing that day. Scientists were betting there was a 90% chance that tephra would be carried east of St. Helens, making cities like Portland, Vancouver, Olympia, and Seattle relatively low-risk areas. But it was all an educated guess based on statistics. The winds, for example, that would carry the tephra straight into Portland are unusual. They only come about 2% of the time. And in addition, the scientists cautioned that only a small part of any tephra hazard zone was likely to be affected by any single eruption. That was as much as they could forecast. For the rest, they had to wait for the eruption.
Well, volcanoes have an effect on our weather, too. In the last century, an exploding volcano actually eliminated a summer, Jim.
Yes, indeed. That can happen. The ash, naturally, it cuts out the sun and eliminates the sunlight from getting in and cools temperatures. Temperature in eastern Washington fell as much as 9 degrees as the skies turned dark. As you saw in those pictures from Yakima, Washington, it was just like nighttime. We've had reports now of ash as far away as Butte, Montana. Skies are getting dark in Darby, Montana, southwest of Missoula. The wind flow is generally from the west to the east, or slightly southwest to slightly northeast. It is taking a little bit of a turn toward the southeast as it passes, and there is a possibility of some ash fall in extreme northeastern Oregon. But basically, the ash fall has been all in eastern Washington. And looking ahead at our wind forecast, we really anticipate no change in the winds. Now, we've taken satellite pictures over the last several days and put them together, or over the last several hours, and this is what it looked like at 9:15 this morning, a computer-enhanced infrared satellite photo. The dark area there in the center is the ash plume. It's showing up as dark on this infrared photo. Now, we're going to fade into 10:15, 1 hour later, about 2.5 hours after the volcano erupted. You can see the ash plume has intensified and moved downwind toward the east. Now, by 11:15, it had extended past Yakima and was approaching Spokane and Walla Walla. By 12:15, it was almost to the Idaho border. By 1:15, it had moved almost across northern Idaho and was approaching the Montana border. By 2:15, it was on that border. There it is at 2:15, and our last picture in this sequence of infrared enhanced satellite pictures shows the activity as of 3:15. There it is, just to the Montana border. As I say, we've had reports now of ash as far east as Butte, Montana. Now,
the mountain first became active in March 20th. There was one seismometer, and the folks from the University of Washington Seismology Lab went down and confirmed that there was earthquake activity. So there was some scrambling that went on as the earthquake activity built. to establish additional seismometers around the volcano.
For those who grew up in the Pacific Northwest, the sight of a volcano's snow-capped peaks always brought a sense of awe and beauty, but hardly ever a feeling of danger.
I can remember being in a classroom, and we were talking about the Cascade Mountains and being told Mount St. Helens was a dormant volcano. I never imagined it ever had the potential for doing what it did.
A lot of these guys have been around here all their lives, families that homesteaded in the valley here. Stories of their dads and granddads that had worked out here also. So the general feeling was this was not going to be anything big.
I mean, everybody's got a volcano that's idling somewhere around them, you know, but nobody expects to ever have to deal with it or be there when it happens, because it's, you know, hundreds or thousands of years in between. I'd be long gone before that thing would ever erupt. That's what we used to talk about.
Of course, there are some people who are not all that surprised when the mountain came alive. If you know where to look, there's evidence all over this area of past eruptions, such as Silver Lake, which is the product of a mud flow from a long time ago.
On the south side of Mount St. Helens, we have the Abe Caves and the Cave Basalt lava flows, which are a tremendous attraction. And they're from a one period, as far as we know, in Mount St. Helens history, about a couple thousand years ago.
That impressed me. I don't know how long it'll take for that region to be open even for normal movement of traffic. Enormous blocks of ice apparently are still covered by literally hundreds of feet of fluffy face powder type ash, and as that ice is melted under the hot conditions that exist, enormous cave-ins are taking place. Steam is bubbling up. There are a few fires about. Someone said it was like a moonscape, but it's much worse than anything I've ever seen, pictures of the moon's surface. Fortunately, the number of people in that region was minimal, but it is literally indescribable.
For families.
Those of you that haven't been in there and haven't seen it, the devastation is just something we're not going to be able to explain to you. You're going to have to see it to believe it.
The final briefing just before the mission to the mountain. The men get disturbing news. There's more risk than usual. A 5-foot-high volcanic bulge has appeared near the site of today's search, a mining camp where three people are missing. Army pilot and Vietnam veteran Russell Capps, who has logged more than 3,600 hours flying helicopters, can only warn his men, not prepare them, for what might happen if there's another eruption.
If it does blow, you can expect large rocks, of course, ash clouds, and a speed of 100 to 200 miles an hour.
A farmer's field is the temporary landing strip for the helicopters. It's the last bit of familiar ground the searchers will see for a while. The men take along survival kits. They may be trapped on the mountain overnight, as one helicopter crew was the night before. Deputy Sheriff Brian Hill is Hauser's partner. Hill has trained the dog for 2 years. Hauser's learned how to track down human beings, dead or alive. The helicopter pilots are from Fort Lewis, Washington. This kind of flying is not unusual for them. All of them have been trained to fly behind enemy lines and pluck out wounded soldiers. A convoy of four helicopters flies toward the mountain. The search and rescue team on board one, local lawmen and our camera crew on another, plus some smaller choppers to act as aerial scouts in the attempt to locate the missing family. The pilots stay in constant contact with the ground base as they head toward the search area. First, we fly over the lush green forests and clear lakes of western Washington, unaffected by the fallout from the eruption. About 20 miles from the volcano, we spot the first dramatic evidence of the blast, a layer of ash blanketing the landscape, abruptly transforming it from green to gray. Then, 15 miles from the crater, we begin to fly over land that has had all the life blasted out of it. 150 square miles of timber once valued at $200 million. Trees 6 and 8 feet in diameter were pulled out of the ground, stripped of bark, branches, and leaves, and toppled like children's pickup sticks. The choppers search and circle as they travel. The 35-mile flight to the mountain slope takes almost 50 minutes. Finally, the helicopters locate today's search site, a mountain ridge just 3 miles north of the volcano's new crater. The pilots find stable patches of ground large enough to allow a safe landing. Deputy Hill and Hauser are first off the helicopter. They will lead the advance team of searchers. This party will go ahead to try and find the mining camp where the missing people lived and worked. Ducking to avoid the still spinning blades, the men move away from the copter and gather on a knoll. They then face their first big problem, simply finding out where they are.
This country is ruined so bad that the landmarks on the map and what you have out here is absolutely two different things.
The searchers set out and immediately encounter the problems of moving on the ground. Trees that look like tinder from the air turn out to be 6 to 10 foot high obstacles that must be scaled, scrambled over. What was once a magnificent forest has become an obstacle course of huge proportions. To qualify for this kind of rescue work, a man should be able to walk 30 miles a day. These men will walk a mile and a half today. At the end, they'll be exhausted. Once, deer, bobcat, cougar, bear, and elk roamed this wilderness. Now there's no life within a 15-mile radius of the crater. The only movement is the search team. The only color, the gray ash. The only sound, the helicopter, which points the searchers in the right direction.
Right now, the search and rescue party has gotten far ahead of us. They're up on the side of the mountain now, at the site of an old gold mine where they believe three people may have sought shelter right after the eruption.
The ash and muck is 4 feet deep in places, covered with a thin crust that breaks at the slightest touch. The ash itself covers 3 feet of snow on the mountain. When wet, the stuff pulls at the boots of the men. When they use a fallen log as a bridge to cross a ravine or as a stairway, the wet ash makes the surface slick and dangerous. Before the eruption, Elk Lake was a major landmark here. The force of the blast blew all of the water out of the lake and filled it with mud and debris. Elk Lake just doesn't exist anymore.
It became quite a community-wide event.
The problem? Your domestic well pump just quit. The solution? Call 452-PUMP.
Our library, at the time, the library director's retired, Mr. Ostrander, and asked him if he could find any evidence somewhere in the library archives, internationally or nationally, about an urban area that was impacted by an ash fall. He came back a few hours later and said, "You're going to be the model for the future. It doesn't really exist in modern times."
Don Thompson and the Red Cross opened emergency shelters in Sunnyside, Yakima, and Natchez. The highways were closed and hundreds of travelers were stuck in the valley with no place to stay.
What we were finding, for one thing, was the elderly people said by the clock it's supposed to be daylight and it's not, so we're going to go to a shelter. And they'd sit in the shelter until the clock said it's supposed to be dark outside, they'd go home. We had other people who ran out of medicine, had appointments to make, and they ended up calling, and we tried to be everything we could to everybody else.
So we were dealing with something that we knew very little about, and we were trying to cope with that and trying to figure out, was this ash dangerous? How do you solve all these problems that it caused? It just had so many angles, so many different things that you had to work through that it just became a tremendously big story.
Bell and Craig Allen knew that this was the story of a lifetime.
this was the epitome. I mean, this was like the Hindenburg disaster or the assassination of Kennedy, something like that. I mean, no question about it. We were pumped.
And the rest of the world knew it too. Focused its attention on Yakima. News organizations from across the globe called in looking for the story.
And we were getting calls every day from ABC, get his tape, get his tape. And we had a heck of a time, a very difficult time getting tape out to the network to cover that. But then toward the end of the week, one of the tapes we did get out was to this obscure agency. They called me up and they gave me their name, and it was C something. I couldn't remember it. But finally I sent a tape out to this obscure little news function that had called from this obscure location in Georgia, got it out, and it was CNN. And this was one of the first stories that was ever carried on CNN, because they had gone on the air about 3 or 4 days before that, or a week or so before that.
One thing kind of humorous about it was the first thing a lot of them wanted to know was how many people have been killed, how many people are dead there in Yakima. I said, none. So they'd immediately lose interest. It wasn't such a big story. Oh, really? they were mildly interested then, but they would have liked it, I think, from a news standpoint, a lot better if I could have said, well, we've had 20 dead, and all this kind of thing, but of course we didn't.
While no one died, Yakima had quite a mess on its hands. With the state's emergency resources tied up dealing with the death and destruction on the volcano's west side, city manager Dick Zase knew Yakima was on its own. He ordered resources in from other communities. Trucks came from as far as California. Public works crews removed the ash around the clock.
Altogether, we moved over 650,000 tons of ash off of rooftops, off of buildings, off of the parking lots, the streets, the sidewalks. So it was a tremendous effort to relocate that.
They dumped 250,000 tons of ash at what is now Yakima's Chesterly Park. Another 250,000 tons now fills the infield of the fairgrounds. The abrasive, clogging ash caused $2 million in damage to Yakima's wastewater treatment center. And another $2 million was spent on the cleanup.
Telling stories. It was just a beautiful night.
May 18th, 1980, Swift Creek, 5:30 a.m. Tree planting crew chief Kathy Anderson informs her crew they will abandon their site near Clearwater Creek and relocate to Swift Creek, 6 miles south of the summit.
I'm still not certain what caused me to have that thought. It was out of the norm for us to stop working in one area and go to another when we weren't finished.
One member of her crew, Cran Kilpatrick, is surprised by her decision.
We were actually going to someplace much closer to the mountain than where we were on Saturday, and potentially a lot more danger.
As the sun rises over Mount St. Helens, Jim Skamanky and a three-man thinning crew begin cutting saplings 13 miles from the summit. 100 miles away, at the airport in Yakima, Washington, a Cessna 182 takes off on a reconnaissance flight over the volcano. On board is geologist Dorothy Stoffel.
It was my first time to fly in a small plane, and I was a little anxious about it, kind of unsettled, and really not knowing what to expect.
At the USGS office in Vancouver, 40 miles from Mount St. Helens summit, geologist Don Swanson is waiting for colleagues to arrive.
People were going to bring me supplies that I could take up to live from when I was up at Coldwater 2.
Volcano hazard specialist Dan Miller starts out on the two-hour drive to Coldwater 2. He's bringing supplies and parts for the two time-lapse cameras.
I drove over to the battery shed and picked up all of the batteries that I had on the charger overnight.
Nearly 8 miles west of the summit, Robert Rogers and his friend Francisco Valenzuela arrive at the Sheep Creek Overlook. They have just finished another illegal climb. They park near ham radio operator Ty Kearney.
He looks up and says, well, where were you boys this morning? We made up some story of driving around. We didn't want to tell him we'd gone into the red zone.
8:30 a.m. Just above the summit, geologist Dorothy Stoffel is taking photos of the volcano.
We were flying directly over the South Crater Wall, about 500 feet. And as we went over the mountain, I took pictures of Harry Truman's lodge.
Lou Moore is making breakfast at her family's Green River campsite.
Tara had been brought out of the tent and sat next to where Lou was working. Bonnie was wandering around. I was wandering around.
I was hanging out down in the room with the seismographs.
We dropped John off at his unit and his crew, and they started to plant their trees.
I was heading up Interstate 5.
We made a decision. We'll make one last pass.
1 mile beneath Mount St. Helens, an earthquake measuring 5.1 on the Richter scale shakes the mountain, setting in motion a terrifying chain reaction. Mount St. Helens erupts with an explosive fury, next on Minute by Minute.
Of mining equipment, a compressor they know must have been near the mine entrance.
Okay, we're approaching the compressor at the mine. Can you give us an approximate location of the cabin from the mine?
If they're in the right place, maybe, just maybe, someone may still be alive there.
Okay, there's a dead end spur come out. And then they walk right off that spur into the mines. We're right there. We're within, like I say, you know, everything's covered in mud.
Oh, God. These guys are standing outside. They could be under 30, 40, 50 feet in mud.
The mine only goes in a short distance, but we got about 4 feet of ash out here on the ground.
Inside?
Negative. Positive on that. We'll start working our way downstream towards you from this location.
Quickly, the searchers are convinced there's no one left at the mine. They move downhill looking for a likely place for a cabin, but it's getting late.
Okay, it's 4:45 now. We better start working up on that knob.
You gonna finish up there?
I hope so.
The weather is closing in. The men are getting anxious to get off the mountain. But they know the cabin is up here somewhere, and the missing people. The searchers and the dog hauser come to a clearing just as the helicopters are being called in to pick up the search party.
All they need is verification where they're going to pick us up, Rover. That's going to save us about a half a mile walk through this stuff. I think we just found the cabin. We'll get back to you in a minute.
Hauser is sent in first, encouraged by Deputy Hill.
Good boy.
The roof of the cabin is completely flattened. Not much left underneath.
That's a good boy.
Okay. Yeah, I think we located one line.
Okay.
Yeah, we got one victim here. Just a second before we contaminate, let him search some more.
A body has been located, and the professionals take over.
Seek him, House.
Seek, that's a good boy. That's a good boy.
Hauser's success is praised by his partner. He is urged to keep searching. The highly trained dog can smell a body even under the deep layer of ash.
Seek. Seek. Oh, good boy.
There could be another victim right there.
Victim number two, buried beneath a foot of suffocating volcanic ash.
Okay, one more.
Good.
Okay,
good.
Check and see if there's a victim right there. He identified there for a second.
You find something there?
Hauser continues to search as members of the rescue team look on.
See?
Within minutes, it is over. Victim number three. The locations of all three bodies are marked for recovery later, after the oncoming bad weather clears. The searchers move slowly now, attaching red markers, the only color on the mountain. Helicopters arrived to retrieve the exhausted team members almost 4 hours after the mountain search began.
Let me ask you something.
Okay.
How's it feel now? You succeeded in a sense.
Well, yeah, we succeeded. It probably will benefit the family a whole lot. And that's was our major concern. That's the reason we were here today. The possibility of survivor in this area is, obviously, as you can see, is very, very doubtful.
This was the 12th trip since the eruption for these men. There are still 71 people missing.
The result is a successful overall survival rate of 80%. Plants growing on hillsides facing away from the volcano in the lee of the blast were the most likely to survive. Here, the scouring action of the blast did little to disturb the forest cover as it surged up and over the ridgetop. Few plants survived on the side of the ridge that faces the volcano directly. By far the most extensive plant cover today is found in areas that were cleared of timber before the eruption.
So do some of the scientists, thinking the volcano may belch and spit off and on for months or years. Something is going to happen on the mountain. Sunday morning, he watches his premonition come true as he films at the foot of the exploding peak. Suddenly, he is trapped in hell. The wind howls through the forest around him. A road disintegrates in front of his car. There is no way out. As the ash cloud comes after him, Crockett turns on his camera and talks into the microphone, knowing these words will be his last.
Dear God, whoever finds this, I don't know. Oh, you can't see this, I'm sure it's too dark. I've left the car behind. First to the gear, we got one magazine. And as you can tell probably from this picture, I'm walking towards the only light I can see on top of a ridge. I can hear the mountain behind me rumbling. An enormous mud and water slide came down and washed out the road. I never really thought I'd believe this or say this, but at this moment, I honest to God believe I'm dead. There's really no way to describe those feelings. I feel the ash now in my eyes. It's getting very hard to breathe. Burns to breathe. The wrong attitude here. I mean, this would be something to tell my grandchildren about. Oh, man.
10 hours later, a Coast Guard helicopter rescues Dave Crockett from his personal hell. He will live to tell his grandchildren about Sunday morning, May 18th, 1980.
Zay says he's often asked if he knew at the time how the city would pay for it all.
The answer I gave then, and it's still the same, is I couldn't worry about it at the time. I knew I had sufficient capacity, if necessary, to issue debt or to borrow funds from other sources. and that this was an emergency that would have some recovery of state and federal emergency disaster relief. The message to me was, get this community back online, and we'll figure out how to finance it and pay for it later.
And that's just what they did. Al Bell says the community came together, and together they overcame adversity.
It became quite a community-wide event, and everybody kind of cleaned up their yards and everything, and it became a kind of a community pride thing.
But it was remarkable within 10 days here what we accomplished in terms of cleaning this community up and having as much done in that short amount of time as was possible. And it couldn't have been done without the help and support of the community, residents, citizens, business people, and employees, and city, county, state, federal, state government, that all worked together here in such a cooperative way. I think that really was the effort that made it all possible.
Washington Transportation Secretary Sid Morrison is also a Zilla area farmer. In 1980, he was a state senator running for the U.S. Congress.
The campaign came to a screeching halt, and we shifted all the efforts from all the farmers who couldn't do anything in their fields anyway. And we mobilized a lot of equipment to do things like help the city, help the county, move a lot of ash, the fallout. Actually, it wasn't ash, it was more like sand, very, very heavy sand.
After Morrison was elected to Congress, he helped establish the Mount St. Helens National Volcanic Monument.
He didn't have a lot of experience in doing this. So what do? Do you have the Park Service run it? Is this someplace that people come to visit? You have the Forest Service run it, because it was the forests that were decimated, many of them private, some of them public. And the decision was to stay with the Forest Service and have this be a research project of how forests regenerate themselves.
In the end, Congress set aside 110,000 acres around the volcano, an area to be protected for research, recreation, and education.
I think over time we'll not only see the wonders of nature and the amazing force of nature, but we'll be able to know a lot more about how Mother Nature recovers from volcanic action and how we can help Mother Nature.
Over the past 20 years, this National Volcanic Monument has grown. Millions of people visit here every year.
But William and his fellow campers had a front row seat to the largest movement of land in recorded history. It's simply something to which the rest of us will never be able to relate or understand. Even the incredible statistics are difficult to comprehend. The upper 1,300 feet of the mountain slid away in a massive landslide. That amounted to a volume of 0.6 cubic miles, or 3.3 billion cubic yards of earth. Some slid into Spirit Lake, where it sloshed the water out as if in a bathroom sink and raised the lake floor 200 feet. This cataclysmic scene was measured in seconds. And by the time the group's initial shock was subsiding, they had to deal with the next unexpected phenomenon, the deadly pyroclastic cloud.
Well, finally, when we all got in the car and we started to go down the road, the ash cloud was skirted by our campsite, and the cloud from ash was rising higher and higher, where we could see the electricity in the cloud. And it was violet, white, blue, and I couldn't understand what was inside of the cloud either. I mean, we didn't know what was in it. And what it was, it was dust creating electricity, and these sized rocks started pelting us on the car, dented the car up pretty bad. And I was wondering which one, which rock had my name on it. You know, was it a one-ton rock or?
William was one of the lucky ones, for his party had camped only 500 yards from the fickle path of the pyroclastic cloud, a virulent mass of heat, gas, and rock traveling in excess of 300 miles an hour. Conspiring with the unstoppable tidal wave of earth and mud, this unbelievably powerful blast would ultimately level huge forest trees 24 miles away and take the lives of 56 others. Not so fortunate as William. I finally came close to realizing what those few survivors already know. When we landed in the middle of the blast zone, just 8 miles from the mountain, and looked into the crater of Mount St. Helens, 10 years after.
And I looked out the south window, and it was like watching a movie. When they fast forward the movie, the clouds were rolling in. The clouds were really black and rolling. They were rolling.
Ten years and one day ago, the North Toutle River flowed through a verdant green valley. A highway ran along the river connecting the Weyerhaeuser base camp with nearby towns. Now, it looks like this, covered in places by hundreds of feet of rock and sediment from the mud flow that rolled off the mountain and wouldn't come to a stop until it reached I-5.
It began with what they called the pyroclastic flow, which was the first thing out of the mountain. And that was just an accumulation of these large blocks of ice or icebergs out of the mountain, part of the guts of the mountain itself. And the mixture of water and soil and burnt rock and all those things. And as that went down the valley, it mixed with the side streams that came in, the water, and became much more viscous. Started out very slow, moving only about 2 or 3 miles an hour. By the time it got to I-5, it was probably traveling at 25 to 30 miles an hour. And it was more like just mud then. It was a little different up here.
The rainfall gets heavier. Head for home to begin again tomorrow.
The Mount St. Helens volcano remained relatively quiet today. Steam clouds rose thousands of feet into the air, but there were no explosions. Stephen Geer, who's been watching the volcano from the days of its first eruption, took advantage of the lull to get another good look at the main crater.
Mount St. Helens used to rise above the clouds in snow-capped majesty. Now the volcano becomes blacker with every eruption. The clouds today topped off at 5,700 feet. Our ABC News helicopter climbed to the 8,400-foot level to the rim of the crater, where cameraman Charles Jones photographed the plume of steam that continues to rise from the mountain since last Thursday night's eruption. Although the heavy ash fall produced by that eruption has ceased, you can see that plumes of ash are still thrusting up from the crater. These photographs raise the question of whether a lava dome may be building in the crater, as reported, then denied by U.S. Geological Survey scientists late last month. We asked Dr. Tom Benson, a geologist at Portland State University, to examine today's videotape.
One of the things that's most interesting is the way the steam is venting in almost a circular pattern around what looks like broken up rock covered with ash. That's why it's the same color as the ash color you see out there on the outer rim of the inner crater. I think perhaps, or quite probably, highly probable, there's a lava dome at very shallow depth. But we're not seeing true lava at the surface yet. We're seeing more broken rock.
How far below the surface do you think it might be?
I'm thinking we're talking in orders of tens of feet, tens of meters.
Now, if a lava dome builds, what significance would it have for the mountain?
Perhaps a good way to look at it would be the start of the rebuilding process of the mountain. Remember, we're talking about a mountain that was 9,000 feet plus high, and it's been taken down quite a bit, and it should be a building mountain.
Snow and ice melted in the inferno that scorched the mountain, rushed down its slopes, gathering trees, rocks, and power along the way. These mammoth mudflows sweep down both forks of the Toutle River, killing sightseers, ripping apart a dozen bridges, demolishing homes, cars, and logging rigs. 1:30 Sunday afternoon. The mud flows reach Interstate 5, more than 30 miles from St. Helens. They threaten to slice through the bridges there and cut the major north-south route between Seattle and Portland. The bridges hold. The muddy torrent churns toward the Columbia. It chokes the mighty river with silt and strands 24 ships.
I couldn't carry Bonnie. Lou couldn't carry her because she had Tara in her backpack, and Bonnie was basically on her own in between us. She's a pretty tough kid, but for 4 years old, you're asking an awful lot.
12 p.m. The mountain has now been erupting for 3.5 hours.
Is that it over there? I can't believe it's camped up in this area.
The rescue operation is a dangerous one.
The crews are getting tired. The machinery needs to be carefully maintained.
Chopper pilot Ray Pleasant and his crew respond to an emergency call near the Tootle River. When they arrive, they find Roald Reedon and his badly injured girlfriend, Venus Durgan. The crew jumps out and loads Venus in. Pilot Ray Pleasant pulls back on the controls and heads out of danger.
I was able to look back. I just saw this brown body, tiny little brown body in the back with the big eyes looking at me, and I'm just scared.
A second helicopter airlifts Reedon out. The choppers fly across the river to the town of Tootle, where a medevac unit has been set up at a school. 14 miles from the summit, the ash is so thick it is almost impossible to see the ground.
One really interesting contrast in how vegetation has returned to the volcano has to do with the difference between areas that had been clear-cut versus those that were forested just before the volcano erupted. Areas that had been clear-cut had plants in them that were adapted to being in bright, sunlit, open areas with high temperatures, whereas the forested areas had plants that needed a lot of shade. A good example of a plant that does well in such a situation is this plant, fireweed. It can occur in almost any kind of disturbance. And another one is this one, Pearly Everlasting. Both of these species have seeds that can move very rapidly, so not only did they occur in the clear-cut areas, but as you look across the entire volcano now, it's virtually is one big clear-cut, and so they occur everywhere.
The bracken fern has a stem that grows underground. It helps to keep the plant from drying out and to spread rapidly through an area. Through the blast or having efficient means of dispersal is no guarantee that a plant will continue to survive. Not only does it have to deal with drought and the burning rays of the sun, but also elk and deer and the busy northern pocket gopher foraging for food. Underground burrows, small mammals like the gopher are perfectly suited for surviving eruptions. But very little is known about how their activities may alter the recovery of plants above ground. Dr. McMahon believes...
Night wind, cold and melancholy, wail a blue finale for my tragedy, like a miserere meant for only me, while I linger weary neath the willow tree. Right here our romance was started, here again we parted, when I set you free. All my thoughts are jumbled, everything is blurred, all the world has crumbled, shattered by a word. The end has come, my heart is numb, 'twas like a bolt from the blue above. I can't believe it, sky is dark, I hear a lark. He sounds as sad as a mournful dove. The dew appears like the tears of dawn. Darling, for here lies love. All my dreams lost beyond recall. Dreams of spring lasted in. Dry. There's only one thing I'm conscious of. I only know I can't go on, darling, and here lies love. My eyes are dry. There's only one thing I'm conscious of. I only know I can't go on, darling.
Like the light of a new day, it hit me from out.